Good afternoon. The Transportation Policy and Finance Committee will come to order. And may I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Viskowski approves the minutes of, what was that date? February 11th.
And 9th.
Is that right? Correct? February 11th. All those in favor, answer by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Minutes are approved. Members, today we have a number of bills on the up in committee here. Representative Cornish, House File 12, will be first. Representative Cornish. Yep. Representative Cornish, I'll move House File 12 for consideration, and that bill would be moving to the House floor, correct?
Yep.
All right. And did we have an amendment? Representative Cornish was inquiring. Okay. Okay, Representative Cornish, then we'll have to do that on the floor. But please continue with your bill presentation.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, House File 12, I'll give a short description and then turn it over to my testifier. House File 12 basically is a blue alert system. And what that means, it's known in about, it's approximately 20 states, I might have that wrong, but my testifier might correct me, but 20-some states have this system already where a peace officer is seriously injured or killed. It's a way of converting the Amber Alert system here in Minnesota, e-alert, over to a blue alert. So in the event that a peace officer was seriously injured or killed in the line of duty, certain information would be communicated through the e-alert system that's present use for the Amber Alert. And a number of cases in the past where an officer has been injured or killed, there's been a lag time. We've seen it in the recent Fitch case and some other cases where sometimes it can be as many as 3 to 5 houses that are being searched and the highways, and could go for hours or for days without apprehending the suspect. So what this bill would do, House File 12, would be to utilize the Amber Alert system to put this out, you know, over the phones and the screens and alert to the suspect and the vehicle so that more eyes and ears would be on the road and in communities and try to take this suspect off of the road and into custody as soon as possible before any more damage was done. And if Mr. Chair, if I could introduce my testifier, Janelle Rasmussen from the e-alert system from the Department of Public Safety, could explain how the system would work.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I'm the Amber Alert Coordinator at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and Representative Cornish just asked that I give a brief overview of how the Amber Alert system works and how we could use this existing system with the Blue Alert in Minnesota. We currently use a broadcast technology where we send Amber Alerts out through email, fax, and text messages to our members of the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, which includes about 20,000 different locations in the state of Minnesota. We're able to do this through the broadcast technology geographically in the state as well as by category. And we have 52 different categories in the system, ranging from media to hotels, gas stations, schools, all of the different businesses in the state of Minnesota, and then obviously law enforcement as well. So when we send an alert out through the Amber Alert system and it goes through the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, we can hit about 20,000 locations in a matter of about 60 seconds. That's the technology we would use for a blue alert as well. We currently train law enforcement throughout the state of Minnesota to use this system. So it's used for Amber Alerts, missing children, but also for any other type of crime in the state where we want to ask for the public's help in locating a suspect or solving a crime. We also have several secondary distributions that we utilize when we activate an Amber Alert. Some of them may also be used for this to include our social media, road signs, and IPAWS or emergency alert technology as well. And as Representative Cornish said, the blue alerts are in 20 states. That is correct.
And Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to add a couple housekeeping things is that there was an amendment that was supposed to be here. It's non-controversial. It has the okay of the Department of Public Safety, and it just adds two members to the group for a consultation in the interim, how the thing is set up. And also the bill, we requested a fiscal note, and the fiscal note came back zero. So I am, Ms. Rasmussen or I could take questions if you wish, and I also have a couple of survivors that would like to testify also, if they would please come in.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. We do have a question from Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Cornish, for bringing this bill, and I support this bill. So don't take offense to the question I'm about to ask. In fact, I think in your opening you talked about Officer Fitch. I think you met Officer Patrick. Officer Patrick is a was a constituent of mine. His family are still constituents of mine. And so I appreciate your bringing this bill forward. My question, though, is, unlike the Amber Alert, in this instance, would it, in the 20 states that do this, do they post a picture of the suspect or the suspect's car? I'm just wondering about the practical. I know where I live, there were folks that were, when they heard about Mr. Fitch, they wanted to go get him themselves. And I'm just wondering if there have been instances of vigilantism in the other states where this has occurred, or if they just show license plates or numbers, or how it would work.
I will give you a short answer and then my testifier. I'm not really aware of that. Hopefully with other disclaimers that would come out, there would be something there about using caution, about not apprehending yourself, similar to the crime alerts that come out separate from the Amber Alert or Blue Alert system. But I'll let my testifier answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, there have been no situations like that as far as I'm aware. We do, in the alerts that we put out, put information in there for the public and how they should handle it if they know where the suspect is or see the vehicle. We give them information as to what they should do, like dial 911.
Mr. Chair, and again, Representative Cornish, thank you very much for bringing this bill.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Drakowski, this is a terrific bill, and I plan on supporting it. I'm just wondering if you could include the Border Patrol and Immigration as part of this as well. I have a very sad story of a schoolmate that was murdered. He's a peace officer. And if this Border Patrol and Immigration were included on it, you know, 30-some years ago, it might not have happened. So this is a terrific bill. I plan on supporting it.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. So line 2.8 talks about law enforcement officer and the definition. Would that include transit police then, Metro Transit Police?
Representative Cornish.
I suspect that the law enforcement officer or peace officer under statute 626 would define it as a peace officer and would include specifically that person or persons that you're talking about, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cornish, for bringing the bill. I'm curious. It looks like there's no fiscal note on this, so this wouldn't cost us anything, which is good. And we've got a system out there that's been patterned after Amber Alert. Why would we limit the use of this system only to police officers and not anybody in the community who, if there's a suspect that's suspected of killing or seriously wounding anyone in the community, why do we single out police officers and not use everybody in the, or anybody in the community? It's just as tragic for anyone, I would suspect, as it is a police officer.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sprouse, it's a good question. We've purposely kept it that way, I guess, so it's, I hate to compare it to this, but it's like MnDOT tells us about too many deer crossing signs. Pretty soon you lose the sensitivity or the uniqueness, and if we start putting it up for everybody that's seriously injured or killed, it's going to be too much overload of the system, and pretty soon people will not pay attention to it. At the current rate, we only lose, tragically, about one officer per year. But if we include, for the general public, assaults and murders, it would really a lot of overload in the system and would lose its novelty of where people would really pay attention to it, I think. That's the reasoning behind it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Any other questions from members? And Representative Cornish, you did say there are members in the audience that would like to testify.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of them. I think I'll relinquish our chairs here and bring up Susan Merrily and Christine Crittenden, both who have lost immediate family in the past.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the committee record and continue.
Good afternoon. I'm Susan Merrily, and I'm president of the state chapter of Concerns of Police Survivors. It's a national organization that is made up of survivors, family survivors, and coworkers that really support and provide resources to the families that have lost their loved ones. I have 4 points to make. Every time that there is a loss of an officer, the families that have lost their loved ones, they relive those moments. We remember the day that we lost our officer. I lost my father 37 years ago, and even 37 years ago, it takes your heartstrings when you lose an officer and you relive, and you know what those families are going through. The state of Minnesota has lost 16 officers in the last 10 years. We know that it's going to happen again. Not only will the Blue Alert system help apprehend the criminals, but I think it will also prevent a criminal from killing an officer. I think if they know that they don't have far to run, hopefully that will deter them from killing one. And then lastly, it does take a special person to be in law enforcement. And we all know that they don't do it for the wages that they make. I think it's important as a state to take care of our law enforcement officers. They sign up to protect and serve the communities, and I think adopting the Blue Alert system would just be another way for our state to support our law enforcement. Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, committee. My name is Christine Crittenden. I am a survivor of a line of duty death, September 7th, 2009. I think the Blue Alert system has really good merits as far as letting every agency look for who is out there that has injured or killed an officer. In this country last year, in the United States, gun deaths of officers were up 56%, which means there's people out there that are not afraid to use their guns, and if they will kill an officer, they're a great danger to the community at large. We do very well at following the letter of the law and checks and balances of our officers. I think the spirit of the law means that we should give them every available tool to help them so they are not injured further, but to help them do their jobs and keep us safe. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for being here at the committee. Are there any other members of the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Cornish, any other thoughts?
Just that this was brought to me, this bill, by a state trooper, Rob Frisbee, and on to my son, Gabe Cornish, and then to me, and so I was really glad to carry it. And it takes on somewhat of a personal note because I've sang it numerous funerals. In fact, Critter, the officer that was killed, her husband, I sang at that funeral, and so it's a great pleasure to carry this bill today, and I hope you would vote for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? With that, the chair moves his motion that House File, Representative Cornish, House File 12 be recommended to pass and sent to the House floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. That motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Member. Yeah.
Right. Representative Petersburg. Representative Petersburg, welcome to your own committee.
Thank
well, this bill will be is going to be recommended be or is going to be laid over. So thank you for being here, and please testify to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for giving me this opportunity. As we start the process of hearing bills for the omnibus transportation budget bill, I'm very happy to present House File 282 as that beginning and as that start. This is a simple bill that starts to put in place funding mechanisms for transportation into the future. We've heard from Commissioner Zelli and through the TFAC report of various scenarios on funding levels throughout over the next 10 and 20 years. Some of those scenarios include not doing anything and having our system deteriorate beyond what we would care to. We also heard about an additional $250 million above and beyond what we are currently raising just to maintain status and, I think in some words, to deal with it in a controlled level of deterioration, or all the way up to $600 million to stay competitive. And so I think this this is kind of just the start. We've also heard, and I believe, that Corridors of Commerce has been very successful in moving forward the growth and expansion projects needed for competitive transportation infrastructures throughout the state. And it is something that really has been proven, and you're going to hear from testifiers to that case as well. What this bill actually does is it puts $200 million a year as a good starting point, and I think a realistic level of where we need to go. It puts it into Corridors of Commerce for a couple of reasons. One is Corridors of Commerce, as I said before, is our infrastructure growth, and it has the ability to actually go beyond just dealing with maintenance. We've requested the dollars come from the generic trunk highway fund because I believe that allows for the most flexibility. It gives us more opportunities to funded in other different ways. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to, I think we have three testifiers here, and I will let them introduce themselves, if that's okay.
That is fine. Please come to the testifying table and introduce yourselves for the committee record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Robert Voiceman, and I am the president of the U.S. Highway 14 Partnership. The U.S. Highway 14 Partnership is an organization of 18 local governments, 31 chambers of commerce, businesses, and individuals. Our goal is to complete the expansion of Highway 14 to four lanes from New Ulm to Rochester, Rochester to New Ulm. As you consider transportation funding and the projects that need to be addressed, we ask that you include U.S. Highway 14 in your deliberations. Highway 14 connects the economy of New Ulm, Nicollet, Mankato, Owatonna, Dodge Center, Rochester, and all the communities in between. It carries freight in and out of Mankato, medical patients in and out of Rochester, and all the workers and trucks necessary for the cities along the route. In New Ulm, we lack a four-lane highway. Because of that, we have limited our economic expansion. According to our Director of Economic Development, many businesses will only locate where there is four-lane highway. So New Ulm is automatically eliminated, no matter what we have to offer them. As local employees have decided not to expand in New Ulm due to the lack of the four-lane highway. The cost to finish Highway 14 is between $210 million and $320 million. That includes expenses which can be paid for in bond proceeds and those that must be paid in cash, such as engineering and right-of-way access. Corridors of Commerce is a statewide program with many projects in both the Metro and Greater Minnesota. The Corridors of Commerce program has helped make significant progress towards finishing U.S. Highway 14. We asked the legislature to fund the program again this year with cash and bond proceeds and to dedicate a sustainable funding source for years to come. Thank you for your consideration of Highway 14 and all other Corridors of Commerce programs which can enable the state of Minnesota to grow and us to grow our economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Boisman. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Baker, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs for Greater Mankato Growth, the Chamber of Commerce and Economic Development Organization, serving over 900 members in the Greater Mankato area. I'm honored to be here and look forward to sharing with you why the Corridors of Commerce program is a vital tool for our region. Before I begin, please allow me to thank Representative Petersburg for introducing this legislation. and Representative Johnson for your tremendous leadership on behalf of our community and on this particular issue. Please allow me to thank this entire committee for your efforts to create the Corridors of Commerce program and to its continued funding. As you know, we are making good use of those previously appropriated dollars by continuing to make progress on completing Highway 14. But today I'd like to share with you why the Corridors of Commerce program makes economic sense for our state. As you are likely aware, southern Minnesota communities connected by the Highway 14 corridor are among the most economically vital in the state. Obviously, Rochester is poised for strong growth with this Destination Medical Center initiative. Cities like Owatonna, Waseca, and as the mayor mentioned, New Ulm, continue to see positive economic progress. And Greater Mankato's economy is experiencing tremendous growth. For those of you that don't know, the Greater Mankato region received its designation as a metropolitan statistical area in 2008 and currently has a population of over 98,000 individuals, up 15% since 2000. And Greater Mankato continues to outperform the rest of the state on key economic metrics. Greater Mankato leads the state in growth of our gross domestic product. We lead the state in job growth. We are a level one regional trade center with retail spending per capita double all other Minnesota metros, suggesting that large volumes of folks travel to Greater Mankato to do their shopping and access other services. Our region's agricultural heart continues to pump with the largest agricultural income of all Greater Minnesota MSAs. And over the past 3 years, our metro has seen more than $500 million in capital investment, by far and away the best 3-year period of investment in our community's history. Particularly, as you may be aware, Walmart and FedEx have begun construction of major distribution facilities in Mankato this year and will add to the already high commercial vehicle levels on Highway 14 and other highways throughout southern Minnesota. The key thread in all of this is that the need for our community and all of the communities along the Highway 14 corridor to efficiently and safely move goods and individuals across our region has never been more important. Yet as southern Minnesota's economy is thriving and growing, our infrastructure is not keeping up. There continue to be gaps in our four-lane connection across the region, and this is important because a significant amount of commerce takes place within these Greater Minnesota communities as opposed to commerce taking place with ties to the Twin Cities. Additionally, we know from our work with site selectors and new business development that having a strong four-lane connection is a necessary tool to attract significant new business growth. So as the southern Minnesota region continues to grow and become an even bigger contributor to the state's economy, we expect our public partners to do their share by making the necessary investments to provide a safe and efficient transportation infrastructure that supports this region's businesses and commuters, and the Corridors of Commerce program is a critical tool in that effort. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Binker. Are there any questions for the testifiers at this time? Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know what the cost of finishing Highway 14 would be?
We are told that it ranges between $210 million and $320 million. The longer we wait, we all know what's going to happen to the cost.
Mr. Chairman and testifiers, if you needed some money that wasn't readily available, would your legislative delegation from along 14, and I don't know who they are offhand without looking them up, but would they all vote for some increase in funding that we might have to do to satisfy your needs there? Are they all behind you on this?
I sure hope so. I can't speak definitely for them. To my face, yes, they said they were going to support me. So I'm hoping they're telling me the truth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask that is because so many times in the past, the legislators would come in with their mayors from along the corridor there and say we need X amount, and we've given some over the years, but you still need to finish it, and they would not vote for the funding bill when it came time to do that. So last time that happened, I took the legislator and the three mayors out in the hall and I said, look, you have to explain to your legislators that if they want this stuff, they got to vote for it. So that's why I was interested to know if you've got some kind of commitment for them. from them, I guess. Now, is this, I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if this is a question for the author or for you folks, but I'll put it out there and one or the other can answer. Is this Foreigners of Commerce, $400 million, only for Highway 14? Or is there somebody else included in this? Or some other areas?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Earhart. I think that's a very key question to ask. No, this is for the Corridors of Commerce program, which means it's available for the entire state in determination of whatever the Corridors of Commerce parameters are set.
Well, that's, I'm glad to hear that, Mr. Chairman, because it kind of sounded like the only people that got testifying are the Highway 14 folks, but I suppose they're as anxious as anyone to get some additional funding here. So I want to make sure that at least we're thinking about the broad-based metro and rural Minnesota. So I think we find almost a predominance of highway corridor in this Corridors of Commerce are going out of the metro area. I haven't seen all the figures yet, but I have the feeling that as we look back over the program that and to keep balance in the system, we have to satisfy a lot of issues in the metro area as well.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I believe we do have a testifier from I-94 coming up to talk as well, which I think has the same benefit that you've heard from Corridors of Commerce down in greater Minnesota. So maybe it might be time to hear Mr. Bott.
We will. We do have a few more questions before that. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Petersburg. And I'm new. Maybe everybody else already knows the answer. This is my first voyage on the Transportation Committee. But how are you proposing to pay for this?
Representative Petersburg.
Right now, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Representative Atkins. This is going to come out of the Trunk Highway Fund. And so that fund would be just would be reduced by that amount, and so we would still have to find alternative funding for that piece. And because of that, I think a lot of us will support additional funding sources as well. So,
and Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, the additional funding sources that you're identifying, what sources are you looking at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have them at this point. Right now, we're just trying to put in place the funding mechanism for Corridors of Commerce and fit that into the overall budget. As you know, the transportation budget covers many different aspects of funding sources and funding opportunities. And as we heard Commissioner Zelli talk about, Corridors of Commerce primarily is used for expansion and growth, and the general trunk highway funding has been in the past used for general maintenance and deferred maintenance. And so they're kind of two different areas. And we lay that up to the committee and future discussions.
And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Peters, one final quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is this, and I don't have the governor's book with me, but do you know if this proposal is in the governor's proposal for transportation, the Senate majority or the House majority?
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I know that there are dollars in the governor's budget for Corridors of Commerce. I'm not sure if it comes out the same way that he has, but he certainly does support Corridors of Commerce and additional dollars going into it. Both programs do.
Representative Whalen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, is it in the Senate majority or the House majority's proposal?
Representative Petersburg.
Again, all I know is that I've seen dollars in the budget for Corridors of Commerce. I don't know if it's coming out of trunk highway funds or where the funds are. It's just where dollars are put. And I believe some of them had bonding dollars put in and others had some others. And I don't have the specifics of that right now in front of me.
Thank you.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Petersburg, for bringing this bill. I think it's a great bill, and I just wanted to, I do have a question, but to Representative Earhart's mention of other highways that might be here testifying, and I know that in our area, Highway 10 is a potential beneficiary of this. It's even mentioned here on your the Highway 14 handout, so thank you for keeping those other highways in mind. And my question is, I'm just thinking for Highway 10 specifically too, we would love it to be a corridor of commerce, but if by chance it weren't to be, how might this bill, your bill, affect those other projects that are not a corridor of commerce?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure exactly how to answer that question. This is very specific as far as corridors of commerce. So the $200 million per year, $400 million per biennium is set aside for the corridors of commerce and the parameters within that. There has been some discussion about exactly what those parameters are, and because originally they were designed for more shovel-ready and some projects are not there, it may be time for us to look at those at this point. But at this time, the corridors of commerce, as it's set up in current statute, would be the recipients of these dollars.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to answer I didn't see Representative Atkins, but he did ask a good question about, I know that in the Senate bill, they have $800 million over 4 years, so twice as much. And Senator Dibble does have a dedicated funding source to pay for it. So hopefully we'll move towards that approach. But my question, Representative Petersburg, and I did want to thank you for your support 2 years ago when we put this program together. You were an enthusiastic supporter and very helpful. But I wanted to, in terms of, again, following up the question about how to pay for it, in terms of the Trunk Highway Fund, I hope that you're not counting on the unreserved fund balance as a possible funding source, because as I understood Commissioner Zelli last week, that money is already appropriated and accounted for. So I just wasn't sure if you were planning on that as a funding source, because I think that would be pretty questionable at this point. Was that one of your thoughts going into this?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein. Actually, no, I wasn't planning on that, nor on any other forms. I just know that if we take it out of the trunk highway funding in general, it's going to have to be replenished someplace, some way, and that's a discussion for later. Again, this is just a placeholder to get money started putting into the corridors of commerce, because we have many other, again, as I said, opportunities, I believe, or options to consider, and that's something that will be facing us as other bills come forward as to how to put this in place. So this is strictly about corridors of commerce and not about the overall general tax bill or the transportation budget bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Chair Kelly. Representative Petersburg, you've been trying to inform us on what would be affected, and right now there is no additional funding proposed in your bill. So, Chair Kelly, I think it'd be appropriate to ask MnDOT to come up and just briefly talk about their process and what would be affected in their program, or how would they go about determining what wouldn't get funded, because it seems to be a little bit of a, as of right now, the way it stands, a shell game. We're going to fund corridors of commerce, but that means somebody else isn't going to get funded. Would you?
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. At this point in time, this bill is, as Representative Petersburg has said several times, is a placeholder. It's about corridors of commerce. We are going to lay over this bill for possible inclusion. So I think at this point in time, it'd be a little preliminary. I think there's much more discussion to be had at this committee level, for certain that will unfold as we continue with the committee process. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Petersburg, or maybe Mr. Busman, many cities are exist alongside Highway 14. Have they made commitments to help fund the interchanges? I see that is happening along some of our major highway systems. And cities show their interest and motivation, I guess, to have this done, by helping with the funding of the interchanges.
Mr. Boisman.
Thank you for that question. I do not have personal knowledge of anyone coming to any of the cities and asking for assistance with the interchanges. If that's something for the future, I can't answer for the city of New Ulm or the county of Brown or any of the other places whether or not that money would be found somewhere to be available. I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to say that the residents of New Ulm would be ready to help in some way. So what the way would be, I don't know, but we've been waiting a long time for a four-lane.
Okay, great. Thanks, Mr. Bussman.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Petersburg, in the discussion about, you know, where money's going to come from, and that in that area of discussion, I think, is an important one, and one that I think is probably going to happen here later in the process. But it sounded like in the Senate, maybe Representative Bornstein, have they decided, I mean, $800 million they're going to spend, have they decided where they're going to get their money from?
Representative Hornstein.
I'm being asked to yield, I think.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski. The Senate bill does have a gross receipts tax that would be constitutionally dedicated as a new source of revenue. And whether that would be part of that would be spent for this purpose, I don't know specifically if that's been designated in the bill or not, but you know, they do have an idea about where the money would come from.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein, and I appreciate that. I think that's one of the things as we continue to get questions on funding and where the sources are. Even House File 4 has $200 million that is not dedicated to anything. So I would like to remind members that this is a process, and we will continue to go through the process and get your answers or get answers to those questions, but that's exactly what we'll be doing over the course of the next few weeks. We do have another testifier, Mr. Bott. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you, Chair Kelly and Representative Petersburg. Thank you for introducing this bill. My name is Steve Bott. I'm the city administrator for the city of St. Michael and also the chair of the I-94 coalition, which hopefully a few of you have seen some of our stuff along 94, billboards and other things in our Stop Seeing Red campaign. Really want to thank this committee and talk about we've been one of the beneficiaries of this program, and also thank former Chair Hornstein for his support in this, and I see former Representative Beard that was in here when we got this originally adopted, and 94 was one of the initial beneficiaries, and some of the benefits that we have already seen are some of the things I'd like to touch on with this great program. As you may or may not be aware, we were one of the beneficiaries of what we called the first initial phase out of the $300 million that was originally dedicated. We were lucky enough to receive a bite-sized piece to that, and got expansion to six lanes from Rogers, which is in the metro area, out to St. Michael. And I'll touch on a little bit later what some of those beneficiaries and the actual economic dollars that are already coming back to the state in just a second. But we also, with the additional $25 million last year, were able to get the design funded for what we're calling our Phase 2, which would be that continued expansion from the St. Michael area out to the city of Albertville and the outlet malls that some of you may or may not be familiar with. But anyway, we see 94 as a vital, very vital arterial. It's the top freight network outside of the metro area in greater Minnesota. It does stretch through the metro area. Our coalition is made up of many members stretching from the Twin Cities and Maple Grove all the way out through St. Cloud and beyond to both the recreational area in Brainerd and Alexandria, as well as North Dakota, and the advantage that our state's been able to see from the oil boom out there. There is overwhelming support for 94 and this corridor's of commerce funding along the entire corridor. One of the interesting things, not only do we have the businesses, but you see before you, we handed out what we call jamgrams, kind of we try to get people as they're stuck in traffic and hopefully not texting, but talk about some of the, I think Representative Hornstein called it, the quality of life issues that we see that this can have, not only the economic benefit, but also the quality of life issues on those individual commuters and such. So a couple key points on 94 is that it is in our interregional corridor. That's basically all the main regional arterials outside of the metro area. It is only made up between Highway 101 and Rogers and St. Cloud, 1.6% of the entire mileage of that, just one little piece. However, it accounts for 40% of the congestion in that whole interregional corridor. So the bang for the buck and return on investment, as I'll discuss in a second, is just phenomenal. We're very excited and thankful for MnDOT looking at our corridor, looking in the legislature with this bill, looking at things like return on investment, like average daily trips, like freight volumes and things like that that we think really equate to the benefits from this program. We also have twice the crash severity of any area along the statewide average in this section. There's also 2 million trips annually to the Brainerd Lakes and Alexandria area coming through this section. And there's a number of companies along here that have testified in the past at hearings like this and others. One that specifically rings out is Golden Plump out of the St. Cloud area that actually calculated how much money they lose every year on 94 stuck in congestion with their just-in-time delivery, and it's over $200,000 a year. And when you equate that along all the other businesses along the corridor, it's huge. One thing I did want to talk about is the specific benefits that being named as a Corridors of Commerce project in 2013 has directly benefited just in the last couple years. There has been over 2.5 million square feet of industrial development that has started in the Otsego-Rogers Dayton area, and that's just right there. You can see there's been a FedEx distribution center that's coming. Obviously very heavy need on freight and things like that. All that related to being started after this program. There's also potential for an Amazon distribution center. The jobs, the tax base, the sales tax and other revenue that brings to the state is already happening by just that one small bite-sized piece, and we're hoping to continue to keep it going. You heard from our friends at 14 in the region around Mankato and New Ulm. We're very closely tied with the St. Cloud region. I know a lot of you are familiar with that, but they've basically gone on record to say that they're, without improvements to 94, they're essentially choked off and really restricted with their development. Quality of life issues, I mentioned just that one bite-sized piece is saving over 2,000 hours of travel time a year. Now that divides up into many different minutes, but every family, every business gets a couple of those minutes that can help. So in summary, I just really thank you for the opportunity to talk about this program. We thank our partners at MnDOT for selecting our project, and look forward to that continuing. I do know there was a question earlier about the division, and in the last, it was roughly split 50% Metro and 50% Greater Minnesota, how that $300 million was split out. And in conclusion, when we were here on Thursday, appreciate all the meetings with many of you, including the chair, that we had. Representative Pepin asked a specific question when we met with her, and it was, where is this on MnDOT's plan? Where's 94 on MnDOT's plan? And I went into my typical spiel of it's, you know, really important, and we're number one in District 3 and all this stuff, and she said, no, where is it on the MnSHIP list on the 20-year plan? And the answer, it kind of struck me, is it's not. Without this program, without funding for this program, there is no plan from MnDOT to do any expansion on 94. It's strictly preservation, and that's a pretty big deal over 20 years for the growth that we have potential to see. So I thank her for that question, and I would stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Butt. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just wanted to speak in support of the bill. So I live in Dayton, and I live, which is, for those who don't know, it's the northwest, just outside of the seven-county metro area. My wife and I moved up there a decade and a half ago, and I wanted to give a few examples of what's happened in the last decade and a half. When we moved out there, it was mainly cornfields. Cornfields in Rogers, cornfields in Champlin, and when I moved out there, Representative Uglem, there was the 610 overpass over 169 wasn't even built yet. And so there's been a tremendous growth out in the Northwest. And we have many roads that run through the area, such as US 169, US Highway 10, Highway 610, Highway 101, and Highway 241, and I-94, just to name a few. We also have had expansions in bus and North Star Rail. So we've had, up in our area, expansions in all modes of transit. So we've seen a lot up there. The result has been, we have a new hospital, right, in the last couple years in Maple Grove. We've seen several targets in Champlin, in Brooklyn, Champlin and Otsego. We've seen Cabela's. You've already, Mr. Bott testified about several distribution centers that are coming to the area, and there are numerous other businesses. In my experience, and having watching the growth over the last decade and a half, the single greatest impact for economic growth on an area is expanded roads and bridges. Again, and I say that because we've seen the bus expansion, we've seen North Star Commuter Rail. And of all of the things that's happened in terms of economic growth, it is most attributed to expanded roads and bridges. So I speak strongly in favor of this. Now, I know that these highways I had mentioned weren't all, or were not all corridors of commerce. In fact, only I-94 was. But nevertheless, we see the results when we dedicate funds to expanding our roads and bridges. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thurl. Are there any other, thank you, Mr. Bott. Are there any other members of the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Thank you. Representative Petersburg, any final comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. In closing, I believe this is a first step and is one that is needed to guarantee the continued growth and development of our roadway infrastructures. And I know we don't have all of the answers yet, but in this particular Corridors of Commerce legislation, it's a first step, and I appreciate the committee hearing the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. With that, the chair lays over House File 282 for possible inclusion in a bill at a later date. Thank you. Members, before we hear any bills in regards to possibly sending them on to taxes, our fiscal staff has asked for a few moments to address some of the issues that we've asked about, some of the questions that we had. So I'll hand it over to Mr. Lee and Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, to clarify kind of how the committee moves about and receives fiscal notes and revenue notes, when the committee is putting together a bill that spends money, and there's provisions in it that have various costs to agencies or appropriate dollars. Agencies prepare fiscal notes, and part of my responsibility is to try to make sure that the committee always has the fiscal note in front of them that they will be acting on in terms of specific policy language, and you saw that with House File 12. Revenue notes, on the other hand, a revenue note is something that either taxes or creates a tax expenditure, or dedicates money that was going to the general fund, say dedicating the sales tax to transportation would have a cost to the general fund. Those usually require revenue notes. And the Department of Revenue, which prepares revenue notes, has a policy to only prepare revenue notes if a bill is being heard in the taxes committee. However, in some situations, we are able to get revenue notes a little bit early. That's the case for House File 215. So just to kind of clarify on how that works, and I would be happy to take any questions on that.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Lee, or maybe Mr. Chair, you could answer this too. Is this bill going to just move then on its own or be part of a broader transportation funding package? Because I think in the past when we've had some tax implications for the bill, even something like this or a new tax. It started in the Transportation Committee, then as a package went to the Tax Committee. So I'm just kind of wondering procedurally, I saw on Wednesday we have a couple of bills that are similar that also are sort of transportation-related taxes. So will they just move on their own, or do they come back here? Or procedurally, what happens then? Or are you going to lay this one over for possible inclusion, and then a bigger bill goes to the tax bill? I'm just interested to know procedurally where we go with this.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. The chair of taxes would like to hear these bills, so it's the intention to hear these today, and if it passes, it would be moved to taxes. So that's what the intention of these bills, and the ones on Wednesday as well, that are dealing with taxes.
So, Mr. Chair, then this will be the last we'll see of this bill, or it'll go into an omnibus tax bill, or where does this end up? What's the route for this to go to the floor?
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. At this point in time, unless ask for assistance from Mr. Lee or Mr. Burris on just proper protocol or what we've done in the past, but I guess the best answer right now is that we're not sure if we will actually bring these back in to include them in a possible omnibus bill as well. That hasn't been determined yet. Do you have any other thoughts?
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on that, I'm looking at the fiscal analyst. I thought our usual procedure was that this committee is charged with how are we going to fund transportation. We hear lots of bills, we consider the implications, and then we finally determine what are we going to propose to the legislature in terms of how we, and then granted if it has tax implications, that whole bill goes to the tax committee, at which point they look at the tax portions of it. But it confuses me how do we sort of lose track of this, because this is part of how we will fund it. I mean, it looks like we're raising money for funding transportation here. It says allocated to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, House File 215 does move money from the general fund to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund based off of an estimate of auto parts, or how much of the general fund sales tax is attributed to auto parts. So it's up to kind of the chairs and the relevant committees and how they like to order bills and hear things, but I think the idea is that we're hearing the transportation component of that piece of this bill, and taxes will hear the tax piece of that.
And I would add, Representative Hausman, if we do want to include that into an omnibus bill, we can simply ask for it back into this committee after the tax chair has heard it. Any other questions from members? All right. Representative Howe, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 215 for passage and referral to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Representative Howe moves House File 215, recommend to pass and sent to taxes. Representative Howe, to your bill. Oh, Representative Hausman.
Mr. Chair, I think the difficulty passing it alone, I mean, in a sense, when we're asked to vote on this, we have to be asking ourselves, do I want to, because we're cutting the general fund by this much, we're moving it from the general fund to, so we don't yet understand the implications when we cut the general fund by this amount, what other portions of other budgets will be affected, particularly if we have a number of these. So when I'm voting on this, I'm really voting to affect the general fund. I'm just confused about how our world fits with this.
Representative Hausman, I understand the question, and I think it's a good question. I think it's not a matter of cutting the general fund; it's a matter of prioritizing the general fund, and we'll all have to make our our own decisions on whether we feel that's this is the cause for it or not. Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Kelly. And to that point, I think House File 215 actually the question has been all along is how do we provide long-term funding for transportation? And I think this, although isn't the complete answer, I think this is a piece of the puzzle to try and put that together. So House File 215 takes sales tax that's already collected from the sale of automotive parts that currently, as it's already been stated, goes into the general fund, and we dedicate that towards transportation. Like I said, I believe this bill is part of the solution to long-term funding, and I think House File 215 was an idea that came to me as I was doing repair on my own vehicle. And my vehicle, the one I was working on, had over 200,000 miles on it. Years ago, if a vehicle had 100,000 miles, it was considered on its way to the junkyard. Today, that's not the case, as many vehicles now have upwards of over 200 to 300,000 miles on them and still have a useful life. I myself have one vehicle with less than 100,000 miles on it and a stable of four, and two of them have well over 200,000 miles on them. So as I was doing maintenance on one of my vehicles this past year, it dawned on me that it makes sense that the longer vehicles are useful, the less they're overturned, which means we don't get that new car sales tax that's dedicated towards roads and bridges. So why aren't we dedicating that sales tax as we repair these vehicles and keep them on the road and dedicate it towards transportation? The bill requires the Department of Revenue to estimate the sales tax collections from the Automotive Aftermarket Suppliers Association, which is a national database. And that determines the amount of purchases, which in turn determines the amount of sales tax that's transferred from the highway user tax from the general fund to the highway user tax distribution fund. That amount currently is estimated to be about $145 to $150 million a year. The bill is about setting priorities, as the chair said, and I truly believe that transportation funding is truly a priority. And this is not a solution, but it's a step in that direction. And I do, you know, I tell you what, this past year had to replace a rim on my vehicle that hit a pothole, it dawns on me that I'd like the sales tax that I was dedicated for me buying that rim, maybe would go back and fix that pothole so I didn't have to buy another rim. So that, chair, is the bill. If someone's got a question, I'd be happy to answer any questions that come forward.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for bringing this bill up, Representative Howell. In the scope of things, this makes us absolutely nothing more than pirates, you know, for our own cause here in the committee, if we're draining funds away from the general fund. And just to the rest of the committee, we'll be answerable for this, but I will be supporting it. I am a pirate, Mr. Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could respond.
Representative Howe.
Well, if you consider that being a pirate, but I tell you what, we currently have a healthy surplus, and if you're going to make transportation a priority, I think this actually makes that statement that, hey, we're going to use some of that, and we're going to answer the transportation needs that we have.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There will be a reckoning day when we start talking about the general fund here, though.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Representative Howell, thank you for this thought. I'm curious about how this will play out as in terms of the spending side. The money would go into the highway user tax distribution fund, correct?
Correct.
And then I understand that that fund is used to float bonds to build projects. Am I correct in that understanding?
No, Representative Johnson, I do not believe you're correct. Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the Highway Tax User Distribution Fund is the fund that kind of all of the gas tax, the motor vehicle tab fees, and the motor vehicles, or 60% of the motor vehicle sales tax, and if this bill were to pass, the sales tax restricted to auto parts goes into and then is distributed via formula to the trunk highway system the county state aid system and the municipal state aid street system. The portion that goes into the trunk highway fund could be used to bond with and would expand MnDOT's bonding capacity there, but it is not essentially just money to pay debt service for bonds. If it goes to the highway user tax distribution fund, it gets distributed via the constitutional formula.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, but to follow up on that, thank you very much, and that helps my understanding. But the funds that go to for the state highways, that is that we use bonding to fund the roads. Am I correct,
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the state may issue bonds if it so chooses with trunk highway funds or cash, trunk highway fund cash.
Representative Johnson.
I'd like to know how much, I'm curious how much is used for bond, used to back bonds, and how much is used for cash. It's relevant because this affects how we back the bonds.
Mr. Lee, do you have that number?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, in fiscal 2014, $136.4 million was spent in debt service on trunk highway bonds.
Was that your question, Representative Johnson?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is my question. What happens to the cost of those bonds if the money is coming through via the general fund through a sales tax? Because as I understand it, the bonds currently are backed by the gas tax, which is a constitutionally dedicated tax. And I'm just curious, what is the impact on those bonds? And that if I'm buying a bond, I know that's solid because I can see what that gas tax will generate over time. There's a long history, and that's solid as a rock. If I'm looking at money coming from the general fund and I look at the history of Minnesota and I look back 10 years and I see time after time after time, funds were manipulated with the general fund to solve a deficit here and a deficit there, that doesn't seem nearly as solid to me. And does that affect the cost of the bonds that we would be floating to build roads on the trunk highway system? And that's the question I've got. And I don't know, maybe Mr. Peterson could help us with that, or maybe Mr. Lee, you could help me, but I need help with that question.
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and members, I should split out. There's two sources of state-backed debt in general. Trunk highway bonds, which are paid by the taxes dedicated to the trunk highway fund after it goes through the highway tax user distribution formula, and general obligation bonds, which are backed by the full faith and credit of the state but are effectively paid out of the general fund. Trunk highway fund bonds are considered general obligation debt when the Minnesota Management and Budget sells the bonds. There's a constitutional provision that if the highway tax or if the trunk highway fund is unable to meet the debt service obligation of the trunk highway bonds, meaning all of the gas tax, all of the tap fees, and 60% of the motor vehicle sales tax is not enough to pay debt service, the legislature may appropriate general fund dollars to back up that trunk highway debt. That has never happened in state history. But essentially, just think of the trunk highway bonds are secured by whatever comes into the trunk highway fund, and general obligation bonds geo various purpose for Minsky campuses or U of M campuses or what have you, is backed by the full faith and credit of the state and paid out of the general fund. But to clarify, both are general obligation debt, and the state has that pledge to both sources.
So, Mr. Lee, just to maybe help clarify that, would it be safe to say that the state's creditworthiness is really giving us, as opposed to any dedicated funds, is what gives us the rating overall on the bonds?
Mr. Chair and members, I can't speak to how the credit rating agencies rate Minnesota, but I will say that both general obligation geo various purpose for whatever other state bonding and geo trunk highway debt, both usually receive very close to the same interest rate when the bonds are sold.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Then Representative Kelly. And then Representative Howe, I'm curious about, as I understand it, this, you see this as an ongoing process whereby in perpetuity, or assuming that beyond the, beyond this biennium, that we would see this the application of the sales tax on auto parts to go into the highway user tax distribution fund. Am I correct?
Representative Howe.
Yes, I mean, but we can't tie future legislators if future legislators want to change this. I mean, just like most of our bills, they can change any law we have on the books. So, but this does dedicate that sales tax that's estimated by that automotive database, and it would dedicate it towards the transportation fund.
Sam Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so finally, I'm clear in my understanding as I'm trying to figure this out, that these funds would be vulnerable to future, as you said, what the future legislators would choose to do, in contrast to the gas tax, which is constitutionally dedicated to the highway user tax distribution fund. Am I correct?
Somehow.
Well, that's true, but the future legislators could change the amount of the gas tax. So it's all, you can play with any of this, anything we pass. If you want to change it, you could change the gas tax up or you could change it down. Not that many of us think that's the right answer. Some of us may, but this just looks at something other than the gas tax, because in my viewpoint, you raise the gas tax, you hurt the working middle class, the working poor, and that's where you hit them the worst, especially out in the rural area where we don't have a lot of transit to go on. And I think this is a tax that's already being paid. It isn't going to change anything for the working poor working middle class, and I think it just rededicates it and shows the priority that we think transportation should be.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson made some of the points I was going to make. I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, obviously, it's helpful to get money for transportation. But, you know, if this was framed as, well, now we're going to shift to the general fund as a source for transportation, that is a fairly drastic and problematic view in terms of how we long-term fund transportation. I think we can all agree that we need new revenue long term, and so now we have a surplus. It may or may not be permanent. You know, we can't predict what the economy is going to be like or what world markets will be like in the next, you know, couple of years after this biennium. And so once, you know, we get back, if there's a deficit situation, we don't know what the politics will be. We don't know who the governor will be. So if there's a deficit situation again, you can bet that the first thing that a future legislator will go for are these types of funds, you know, and to balance the budget. So I think it's at its core unreliable. And secondly, you know, it does bring us into the realm of if we use it for this, then what are some of the other things that there are other arguably important priorities that we have to deal with in the budget that will be cut or reduced as a result of this. So I prefer a reliable, constitutionally dedicated, reliable, long-term source of revenue to fund transportation. And so if we are starting this, going down this very slippery slope of funding transportation through the general fund, I would really caution against that approach. And, you know, again, I think your goals are admirable, but you know, again, if this is the plan now to go with general fund, I would have a lot of concerns.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up a little more on Representative Johnson's question because I think it is key. And Mr. Lee, I would suggest that what we're talking about here would be a model of a third kind of bond, and that is an appropriation bond. If we use this for bonding, because it requires in every given year that this would in a sense have there'd have to be a budget where we reappropriate this, that it's not the same as geo bonding where we build debt service in or trunk highway where they point to a dedicated source. This is not constitutionally dedicated. The revenue coming from here. So if we're depending on bonding for this, it really falls more into the definition of an appropriation bond which it does have, to your question, of is that that is higher, it's a higher risk debt, and so it's a higher, often a higher cost interest rate. I think that was your question. What is the, you know, what is this approach? So because it's not constitutionally dedicated, because it's in a sense an appropriation from the general fund, that it would fit the model more of an appropriation bond.
Mr. Lee. Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, to clarify, House File 215 does not authorize any trunk highway or general obligation or appropriation bonding. It would, as I would understand it, be a statutory appropriation to the Trunk Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Once funds are in the Trunk Highway Fund, the funds are commingled between constitutionally dedicated funds or general fund dollars. And so for the purpose of paying back trunk highway bonds, it would still count as a trunk highway bond. It would not be an appropriation bond in that sense. And it would be backed by the full faith and credit pledge. So,
Mr. Chair and Mr. Lee, the difference is we now have an account that's made up of constitutionally dedicated funds and non-constitutionally dedicated funds. And I don't think we have any model for that. How, if we did use any portion of that revenue for bonding, for trunk highway bonding, we don't know down the line. It seems to me we're entering into a different field where, I mean, they ultimately have to make their case to the bond council and the companies who have to buy these bonds, and now we're backing them with constitutionally dedicated and appropriations. So I think it's at least something before it gets to tax committee. It seems to me somebody needs to perhaps.
Mr. Lee or Mr. Burris, one quick question. Since these are just sending the dollars to the user fund, isn't it true that any dollars in those user fund, to the extent that they would be used for bonding, are the same?
Mr. Chair and members, once the dollars are in the trunk highway fund as a result of the transfer, they would be constitutionally dedicated to the trunk highway system. It would really be a matter of what the bond houses looked at as far as where the revenue sources are coming from and what level of risk they would attribute to that. One thing I would note, or two things I would note, one is that under this, just the language of this bill, it's a transfer that occurs from the general fund to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. There are no appropriations authorized out of the resulting funds that would come out of the Trunk Highway Fund as a result of the transfer. So it would take additional language. You know, if bonding were contemplated in other legislation, it would take specific language to take a look at that as to what type of bonding would constitute. One other thing, just that the committee is aware, currently the motor vehicle sales tax revenue that's allocated to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, and as a result, a portion goes into the Trunk Highway Fund, is constitutionally restricted to certain purposes, but is not required to go into the HUTD, and so that there are revenue sources that end up in the Trunk Highway Fund that are not constitutionally required to go there, and that's probably a consideration. That's probably a consideration that bond houses already give in the interest rate that they're willing to pay for bonds that have been released in the past or issued, sold by the state in the past.
Representative Earhart.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I say I don't know that why tires aren't in this, because that seems to me those are motor vehicle repair parts. But apparently there's a separate bill on that, or no?
Representative Howe.
Actually, I didn't. I intended for hoses, belts, fluids, and tires to be included. I was as surprised as you were, Representative Earhart, to see that when the fiscal note came back, it didn't include those. So we will be, between the House Research and I are already working on trying to fix the language to include those in the bill, and if it comes back or how this works, it will be amended to include those parts.
Well, Mr. Chairman, do you have any idea how much that revenue is from that? And round numbers.
Representative Howe.
Representative, Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, I would, having just bought tires for one of my vehicles, I have to believe that it's quite substantial. I do not have that number. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to suggest that if something should occur, as we're talking about in the future, and bonds are in place, that the legislature is not going to let the bonds go default. I think there's a pretty safe assumption to make. And the third thing is, this is just another way to get money into the Highway User Trust Fund. We're backfilling general the absence of the money that we're transferring in the general fund with other money, whether it be from the surplus or wherever. That's essentially what we're doing. But it's another way of people who say, well, we need more general fund money, relying on more general fund money than just the gas tax and the sales tax and the tab fees. It's another venue for that.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howe, thanks for bringing the bill. I think it's a very smart idea. And yes, it does, I guess, bring up the discussion of general fund funding for transportation. And I do believe that there are 33 states that do use general fund and rely on it for their transportation funding. What percent, I guess that would be an interesting, you know, additional information. But it's certainly in keeping with a lot of states are thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any testifiers in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Please come down and state your name for the committee record. And we are running behind schedule, so you have about 2 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob again, Carney Jr. I'm a registered lobbyist. I lobby on behalf of We the People, an informal organization, a formal association. You really made my day. This is a terrific idea. We're talking about some very serious dollars here. This is a major step toward covering the whole gap in terms of the amount that we need to fund transportation. And it doesn't run the risk of putting anything into to rail, which I think is great. I've got an MBA from Carlson. Top 10% was regarded as kind of a finance business. And I want to talk very briefly about this issue about the risk on the bonds. You've got constitutionally obligated revenue sources that are going into this fund that are far in excess of the amount that has been appropriated for debt, including the full debt service. And that's really the key issue. As long as that money is there, then the people that are buying the bonds are going to look, well, how much is the money that's constitutionally dedicated going into that fund, and how much is being spent, and the ratio is such that there's not going to be any risk of having any significant difference in interest rates compared to what they are right now. So I am just delighted to see this. I think it's a tremendous step forward, and the logic is there. This is money that is directly related to costs of an infrastructure that is breaking down. So if we get this infrastructure fixed, the taxpayers are not only going to save the tax money, they're going to save the cost of all the stuff that's being taxed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carney. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the questions have been asked, and I would say Representative Earhart went to my first question was oil, washer fluid, tires. You know, there's lots of automotive things that could be added to this. And while as someone who has currently just put my car in to have an axle repaired, I'm, you know, very interested in user fees, and we do this in transportation a lot. But I also worry about going down the line. A lot of these items are sold in grocery stores and other places, and how we'll manage this. But, you know, if we're going down this path in a way that is more micromanaging than we have before, we get into this issue where our erasers and rulers and calculators going to fund education, and our diapers and Band-Aids going to fund health care, and it really makes me nervous. So while I appreciate where you're trying to go, but I'm just not certain that once we start hitting items at you know, your five and dime stores in town, if we're really doing the right thing. So I'm kind of going to stay off the yes column at this point, and until we move down, because in addition to the issues I've just raised, I've also served on higher education, health and human service, and I know that if you're cutting from the general fund, we're going to be taking from somebody else, and I'm still not comfortable with this at this point.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in response, that's why instead of relying on the Department of Revenue to have to do that estimate, that's why they're using the national database from the Automotive Aftermarket Suppliers Association to make that determination of how much is spent.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Okay. Sir, would you like to come down and testify? Again, please state your name for the committee record, and please be brief. Thank you.
Yes, Jeff Forth. I'm a deputy registrar for the state of Minnesota, and I'm the current legislative chair for that association. I didn't realize that our funding was as critical as it is. I began in 1981 in Rochester, and there's three things if this committee is running short of funds I think they should look at. The number one thing is currently under our process and procedure, we charge $10 flat fee on any vehicle, any passenger vehicle, 10 years and older, if it's sold for less than $3,000. And that was instituted about 15 years ago, and that, I think, has had a significant cost to the Department of Public Safety and the transportation. We have, in 1982 was the last time the registration fees were adjusted for any vehicle registered by weight. And that's a long time, and I thought that the legislature would have addressed that years ago. It hasn't been done. So that seems to be an area that could be addressed. The other number three thing that comes to my mind, as a practitioner out meeting with the citizens every day, is the registration of the two of the small utility trailers. They were under the Ventura administration.
Mr. Forth, I'm sorry, but we're just talking about the sales tax on automobile right. parts right now.
Right, and I just, as a citizen or as a deputy registrar, I feel compelled to bring forward some areas perhaps that should be addressed.
Great, I appreciate that. When we look at other of those things, feel free to testify again. Thank you.
Yep.
So, Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to move House File 215 to the Tax Committee.
Representative Howell renews his motion that House File 215 be recommended to pass and referred to taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Howell. Representative Carlson, I guess we're going to take you next. Welcome, Representative Carlson. Hopefully we have a lot of the tax questions already taken care of for you. So,
well, you may have, Mr. Chairman. I was listening carefully because I do happen to serve on the Tax Committee. So,
we got to move the bill, don't we?
But this is a fairly simple, straightforward bill, but it raises a rather interesting question. Mr. Chairman, it would be the repeal of the requirement that sales tax be applied to infant or child care seats. And I don't know if we need a motion to put it before the committee. I'm not on the committee.
Yes, Representative Carlson. The chair will move House File 404 be recommended to pass and referred to Tax Committee.
Okay. And,
please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, as I was saying, that this will repeal the requirement that the sales tax be applied to the purchase of a child car seat, including booster seats. And the history of my involvement with it, I had a constituent who contacted me. They had a new child and were purchasing the various things that you do when you have a new child in the family. And one of them was car seats. And he contacted me and he said, you know, I find it rather interesting, was kind of the gist of his argument that this is something that's required, and it's a public safety issue, and yet we apply the sales tax. So I did a little minimal research. My youngest, I've got three children, is 38, so it's been a while since we've been involved with child care seats. And they are can be relatively expensive. I went by one of the discount stores, and a low-cost one that probably most of us wouldn't want to necessarily purchase was $49, but they quickly take a jump to $100, $200, and even up to, I think, the highest-priced one in that store was $289. So they can be a relatively significant purchase for a couple that's starting their family. So I decided that probably wouldn't be a bad idea to raise that question before this committee and ultimately the tax committee if your committee is disposed to refer it on. So that's it. That's the bill in a nutshell. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Questions from members? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a couple questions. The first, it says in the bill that the car seats would only be exempt if their safety standards established, if they meet the safety standards established by the U.S. And I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that includes all car seats. All car seats have to be approved safe. And then, do you know? So this constituent that brought you the question, obviously he was able to afford a car seat, and he did buy one for his child. Do you? Are there people that who can afford car seats that might now be able to because of this, or is this just because we think it's necessary, we're going to remove the tax?
Representative Carlson.
No, Mr. Chairman, I have no idea what his family's personal finances were. It's when you're dealing with a younger couple, though, just starting out, and perhaps the first child, you're making a number of purchases, and that would be one. And he found it rather interesting, and I concurred that being that this is something that we do require, that it perhaps should be exempt from the sales tax. You know, if you buy one that's the upper end, you're talking $300. That would be roughly $21 in additional cost. Now, you know, I have a district with a full range of income, and I can't speak for what his personal finances would be.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Carlson, for bringing this forward. It does seem like we mandate car seats and then apply a tax to it. That is a little bit excessive. And I know that fiscal note indicates that this is only a tax revenue issue, and so we won't see the fiscal note until it gets to taxes. But do you have any general feeling on what the total dollar of impact it would be?
Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I did ask if there was a revenue note available on it yet, and they told me it wouldn't be until it arrives in the tax committee if it's re-referred.
Okay, thank you.
My personal guess, I wouldn't even put a dollar amount on it. It would be probably relatively minimal to the big picture with the sales tax, but we'll get a revenue note from the tax through the tax committee.
Thank you, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Carlson. I didn't quite catch it properly in your testimony, Representative Carlson, but were you saying that your constituent was suggesting to you that taxes were becoming oppressive for these young families like his?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, that was not the information I received from him one way or the other. I know where you're probably coming at it from, but his whole point was this is something required under the law. It's something that's necessary, and I don't think anybody today would argue that we shouldn't have safe car seats for children. And being that it's required, it did impose an additional cost on a couple with their, I think it was their first child, if I recall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative, I do remember that time in life, and I can testify on behalf of your constituent. It is difficult, and this is a good maneuver by you to help him. So thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. It does make sense that we want to be able to help our young families the most we can, and in addition to just buying one car seat, usually if you're carpooling for getting the kids to daycare, you're often going to have to buy one for other people that are helping you do that as well. So it really would be a substantial help.
Mr. Chairman, just something I hadn't thought of until you just now commented, but my niece just had twins 1 year ago. And that wasn't even on my radar screen until you mentioned that there would be situations where you might need two. I'm at the grandpa end. By the way, we did do a second round of buying of car seats, but the reason I had to go to the store was that my wife had actually made the purchase, and so I wasn't sure what she paid. And our grandchildren range from 5 to 20, but we hadn't really, as sometimes happens, thought about the fact that at some point you might make a second round for those kinds of purchases. So maybe we're helping grandmas and grandpas too.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am very much in favor of lowering taxes to anybody wherever we can. So I am in favor of this bill, but I just wanted to quickly remark on a comment that Representative Carlson made in his opening remarks. And he said something to the effect that this is a pretty straightforward bill. And that reminded me of something that happened to me over this past summer when I was door knocking. So I was, I'll just tell a brief story here that'll make the point. So I was door knocking in St. Michael, and it was about the time of dinner, and the front door, the screen door was open, or it was the only thing open, so I could see inside, and they were family having dinner, so I rang the doorbell, and I saw the gentleman lean back, and I said to myself, oh, well, it's probably going to be a pretty short conversation. So he walked up, still chewing his food, and I introduced myself, and then he said, oh, let me, I want to tell you a story. So he opened up the door, stepped outside, he says, have a seat. Want to sit down on the concrete stoop there. And he says, I'm a small business owner. And I forget what product he sells. I think it was metal or iron or something like that. And he says, I have 5,500 taxing jurisdictions across several states that I have to be concerned with. And there's a lot of... So I'm telling this story because I want us to be cognizant as legislators that while it may seem simple to us, when it comes to actually implementing the law down at the business level, these kind of carve-outs create extra burden when they have to determine who they have to tax, when they have to tax, different taxing jurisdictions at different percentages, etc. So again, this just creates another burden rather than having a streamlined process that makes it easier for our businesses. So just, again, I'm in favor of the bill, but I just want us to be cognizant that it may be a straightforward bill, but it isn't necessarily straightforward when it comes to implementing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cerro. Representative, is there any other, or are there any members of the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Thank you, Representative Carlson. Any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's it, and I just thank the committee for their time.
Thank you. Then the chair renews his motion that House File 404 be recommended to pass and refer to taxes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. That motion prevails.
Thank you.
And we have 6 minutes. Oh, great. Representative Hausman to Representative Mahoney's bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move House File 101. Representative Mahoney was called to another committee for, I think, another bill presentation. So I'm moving it, and Commissioner Rettman is here to present the bill. Commissioner McDonough is here as well. I think he's perhaps not coming.
Welcome to the committee, members. This bill is will be laid over for possible inclusion in another bill later on. Please, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you, and members. My name is Janice Rettman. I'm Ramsey County Commissioner serving District 3. The genesis of this legislative request to include counties in the consent process for MnDOT highway projects comes from the I-35E Cayuga and MnPass projects, the part that rested within St. Paul. This proposed inclusiveness during the I-35E Cayuga and MnPass projects would have provided value-added component for MnDOT, the residents, all levels of government, and would have saved a tremendous amount of time by all parties concerned, and would have achieved a resolution with an informed and involved citizenry. This addition would address the Federal Executive Order 12 898, which I know all of y'all know is part of the environmental justice tenets, assuring the involvement of all peoples, especially in the areas of development and redevelopment and federal funding, especially where there are concentrated areas of economic poverty and people in color, of color. This map of Ramsey County, and although it's from far away, shows some bright gold and some bright red areas. The areas in gold depict areas where there is at least 30 to 39% economic poverty. The red areas are in excess of 49.9% areas of poverty, of the population of areas of poverty. I-35 is the heart and soul of this area. But remember, this is not a poverty of the spirit, but this is literally the heart and soul of the people who live there. Since counties are both boots on the ground as well as funding partners in the highway MnDOT highway projects, county inclusion in the consent process would be most beneficial. In the I-35E, Cayuga, and MnPass projects, the elimination of a well-used underpass trail connection, as well as the removal of the diagonal bridge across I-35E, cut off hundreds of people's residents their daily access to jobs, schools, physicians, shopping, recreation, family worship, and transit. Many of them have no cars. Most all work at minimum wage jobs, many of which work overnight and have their only primary mode of transportation is walking. The outcries for redress over a two-year process led to a modest restoration of the connectivity only after months of talks and meetings.
Commissioner Redman, I'm sorry, I got to apologize, but we are running out of time, and the department would also like to testify on this, so if we could.
Bottom line.
Yes, please, thank you.
This will bring it in on time, on budget, with a lot more comprehensive collaboration and make sure that all people have a right to be have access to transportation.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes, sir.
Representative Hausman.
And Mr. Chair, I was told there was an author's amendment that was that I'm told is a technical amendment just to get the bill before you as the author had intended. That's the A1.
Thank you, Representative Hausman. So we have, it's an A1?
Yep.
The A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it in. Any questions on the amendment? It's a technical amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, my question is to, it looks like we're going to strike municipality and put governing body. Are we saying that there is no city or governing, the city is not going to be the governing body?
Mr. Chair, this is just adding, it says or.
The amendment.
Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to have our staff discuss. Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe. Governing body is the term that's defined for these municipal consent provisions. It's actually that language is on the at the bottom of page one of the bill, and the way that definition is being changed in the bill is to add counties. So it would be both municipalities and counties under the bill language and under the amendment that would be required from whom municipal consent would be required. So it's a clarification over the course of the amendment is a clarification that it's both counties and cities that would need to provide municipal consent under these project scenarios in order for MnDOT to proceed with the project.
All right, any other questions? Mr. Nash.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Question for the author on the technical amendment. Would this also include townships, which may actually be affected in this this new rule?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, no, townships would not be included either under the original bill language that's proposed or the technical amendment.
So, members, we have the technical amendment. Representative Hausman moves the technical amendment A1, the bill. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. That amendment is added. Mr. Peterson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Peterson. I'm with MnDOT, and I will just want to share with you a few concerns I have with Representative Mahoney's bill. What I had distributed to you is copies of the existing process that MnDOT follows for municipal consent, just to give you some idea of the number of steps and the complexity involved in achieving that goal, getting consent on our projects. And a large share of our concern stems from the fact that this bill would then allow or require MnDOT to basically conduct that process with two different governing bodies whenever we're building a project that meets the criteria within the city boundaries. And as you can see from the time frame, on the one side there's the flow chart, on the other side there's a more of a text description and time frames associated with the different steps. That kind of shows how much time is actually involved in achieving this consent at some point. I think it's fair to say that MnDOT works with local governments extensively on every project. We often have, if not in every instance, we often have intersections with streets owned by local road authorities. A lot of times in cities there are city utilities and other impacts that we work with the communities to mitigate. And we always work with, we have a defined public outreach process in which we try to reach out to the public in every instance to see what concerns they have about the project, because we all know that these large infrastructure projects have disproportionate impacts. When we come into a community that's already settled, the costs and the benefits aren't shared equally by all the affected parties, and we want to identify what those differing impacts are and see how we can either mitigate the negative impacts or maximize the positive impacts. That's not to say we do everything perfectly every time, because I'm quite sure that we don't, and I think Commissioner Rettman outlined some of the aspects that we may have not done as well as we could have in that project, and we have worked extensively with her and Representative Mahoney and Commissioner McDonough, who's here, to try and address some of the concerns that were left unaddressed in the 35E project. But I'm not going to get into that in particular, because this is much broader than that. Again, this now would not apply just to projects that MnDOT builds within municipalities, but it would apply to every project statewide that involves right-of-way acquisition, access, or expansion. So it's quite extensive. So just briefly then, I want to mention some aspects of some recent municipal consent agreements that we have. One of the concerns that comes out of this is that in the process of negotiation, you know, oftentimes there are things that we can't agree on. People have different perspectives on how things should be regarded. And then, as you can see again in that process, there's an appeal process in case we don't agree. But some of the conditions that MnDOT agreed to on one particular municipal consent agreement included a requirement for MnDOT to repay the city for a cost share on a previous project. Not this project that we are seeking consent on, but a previous project to which the city had previously agreed. So the city agreed to pay the cost. We came back with a different project, asked for municipal consent, and they said, well, only if you also then pay for this cost share that we had on this other project. They asked us to revisit sound issues related to a bridge that we had constructed, again, as part of another project, and explore mitigation. We added 50% to the landscaping budget for the project. The city also asked us to repaint the noise walls that were constructed as part of the previous project as well. And then they also required that 3% of the cost of noise walls be dedicated for aesthetic enhancement. And again, I don't know if all of these are bad ideas, but things that you think have been settled with a prior agreement on a prior project don't seem to be necessarily relevant to the terms or the attributes of the project that you're currently seeking consent for. And I just bring this up to point out that then the requirement by the department to get municipal consent gets used as a lever to try to get other things for a project. And what this does is that it drives up the cost of projects, and particularly cost of projects for the state. This same requirement asked for but did not get MnDOT agreement to replace a previously existing noise wall that was in place so that it would match the new noise walls that was going up, and the department declined to do that. I just do want to jump down in the interest of time here. There are a couple other projects. There was another project that asked MnDOT to build a new, not replacement, but a new bike and pedestrian trail and bridge that was outside the current project limits. And again, the trail and the bridge may be a good idea, and I'm not offering an opinion about that, just saying that, you know, again, I'm trying to contain the scope of the cost the state's required to pay. Being outside the project limits seems a bit of a stretch too far. So just a couple other points. One is it's interesting that the Minnesota County Engineers Association does not have this legislation on its list of for its legislative priorities this session. In fact, their legislative platform asked that they be relieved of the requirement to receive municipal consent when they're constructing a county state aid highway in city limits. And finally, I would just like to say, you know, we as a department are committed to learning from mistakes that we've made or omissions that we've been guilty of in the past, and doing a better job of addressing local community concerns, and as a response to some of the conversations that we've had with Commissioner Rettman and Commissioner McDonough, we initiated a process to reevaluate the way that we do our early public involvement. And this would be work that would be done even before the first stage that you see on the flowchart before you. So where we would try to get public input on what they see as their concerns about the project as it's described. And in fact, we just had a recent conversation with the two commissioners, and as a result of that conversation, we've kind of redefined what our vision was for that effort. I think we're going to expand it, draw in more external stakeholders, and try to really come up with a solution that works better for everybody, but falls short of this particular requirement in this legislation.
That's all. Representative Hausman.
Just to clarify, so that there's not misunderstanding, the examples you gave about...
Representative Hausman, could you use the mic, please? Thank you.
The examples you gave where it goes awry were not this project or St. Paul or Ramsey County. I just wanted everybody to understand. You were just sharing broad examples around the state. Lest anyone think those were all happening here.
Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hausman, actually, some of the items that I talked about actually were a part of this project, but not from Ramsey County and not from the City of St. Paul. But that does, mentioning the City of St. Paul, if I may, Mr. Chairman, does remind me of another key concern that we have, which is, with this particular project, there's some disagreement about this between the City of St. Paul and Ramsey County. And our concern about this, if we get into a situation where there's a disagreement in the future on a similar project, the department is kind of put in an untenable position between the two disagreeing parties and left with no path forward at that point.
Mr. Rettman, you have one more comment.
Mr. Chair, the City of St. Paul took the staff's recommendation and did not do due diligence in the municipal consent. It was only after the county and District 5 and 6 and 7 raised the issues of that they had not been involved in the process. Also, you've got many people who do not have access to a website, and the involvement was not there with the neighborhoods at all.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, just one question. If you did have to add this to the counties, I would assume this is the template you would have to follow then, and you'd just add county instead of city there?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would largely be the same. Okay. I think because you'd be dealing with two governments at the same time, there might be some slight variations, but I would assume that would be very similar. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Representative Mahoney, do you have any comments?
Just that you guys should all be mad at the Jobs Committee because they stole your cookies. Mr. Chair, I wasn't here for all the testimony, and I apologize for that. This is a bill that hopefully starts a conversation with the Transportation Division and finds, hopefully at some day in the near future, we have a better policy that deals with how we get consent from the area that you're putting transportation to. So I won't try to bore you with anything more than that.
Thank you, Representative Honey.
Was this moved to as a possible inclusion or on its own?
Right now, the chair lays over House File 101 for possible inclusion in a bill at a later date. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Peterson, Commissioner Rettman. Members, thank you for staying with us today. We will be in 1245 in the basement on Wednesday. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.